I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We begin this week with new developments about President Trump and whether he was compromised by Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign. It's a question we now know FBI officials looked into.
We have breaking news at this moment on just how concerned, even freaked out, law enforcement was when President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey.
Here is the headline again. FBI opened inquiry into whether Trump was secretly working on behalf of Russia.
So I'm going to ask you, are you now or have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
Ever since the 2016 presidential campaign, Donald Trump has been dogged by accusations that he and his team were too close to Vladimir Putin and Russia and whether those ties undermine the election. But throughout, the administration has maintained there is and never has been any collusion with Russia.
We've been saying from day one there's been no evidence of Trump-Russia collusion.
There was no collusion, no nothing.
This weekend, the New York Times reported that right after President Trump fired James Comey in 2017, FBI officials began investigating whether he had actually been working on behalf of the Russian government. The president took to Fox News to respond. Here he is talking with Jeanine Pirro on Saturday night.
So I'm going to ask you, are you now or have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing. But the headline of that article, it's called The Failing New York Times for a reason. They've gotten me wrong for 3 years. They've actually gotten me wrong for many years before that.
Here to walk us through the latest reporting from The Times is Nicholas Fandos, a congressional reporter for The New York Times. He was part of the team that worked on Friday's revelations. Nick, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And Chuck Rosenberg is a former United States attorney, senior FBI official, and DEA chief, and he's also an MSNBC legal analyst. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Nick, I want to start with you. What is new in what we're learning about President Trump being under investigation by the FBI?
We've known for a while now that associates of President Trump tied to his campaign were under investigation by the FBI for their ties to Russia. And we've known for a while, too, that after President Trump fired Jim Comey as FBI director back in 2017, the FBI opened an obstruction of justice investigation, which was then taken over by Robert Mueller, the special counsel, into whether Trump's action in firing Comey had tried to obstruct that investigation. What our story lays out is that that second investigation kind of had two different prongs. And one was a traditional obstruction of justice, and the other was geared around the kind of nature of the investigation. And so the FBI found itself asking a question of if this FBI broader investigation is about finding out what Russia did in the 2016 elections and is a national security concern, you know, is the president working wittingly or unwittingly on behalf of the Russians and obstructing it? So there was a national security component, and they opened, as a result, a counterintelligence investigation into Trump and his, you know, potential ties or relations with the Russians in that decision. So that's the element that's new in this story and helps to kind of tie together what it was that our understanding of what it was that Special Counsel Mueller inherited back in May 2017.
Chuck, based on your experience, how significant are these revelations? Especially, as I mentioned, I think a lot of Americans are, you know, having trouble keeping track. I know I am, of what's important, what isn't. So how significant were these findings?
Well, this may sound incongruous, but it's startling and not surprising at the same time. It's startling if you take a step back and think that a president of the United States is the subject or focus of an FBI counterintelligence investigation. That's remarkable. On the other hand, given all that we've learned and all that we know from public records to date, it would be, I guess, more surprising if the FBI wasn't looking at the president as a possible witting or unwitting target of the Russians. So, startling but not surprising.
Can you help us understand the difference between how the FBI classifies criminal investigations and their counterintelligence inquiries?
Sure. Great question. And it's important to know that investigations are often braided or intertwined. that an investigation for counterintelligence purposes could result in a criminal case. And sometimes, though not often, criminal cases could have counterintelligence overtones. What the FBI is doing is collecting information. When we use information in federal court in a criminal case, we call it evidence. When we use information in the intelligence world, we call it intelligence. But it's really just information. If you think about the Mueller team's indictment of the Russian military GRU intelligence officials, that's a great example of a case that could have gone in either direction. It had counterintelligence overtones. Clearly, the Mueller team was looking at what the Russians had done to interfere in our 2016 elections. But in that case, they also charged a crime. And that's where you can see the braiding, or the fact that those two types of investigations, counterintelligence and criminal, can be intertwined.
And I'm wondering, does the fact that this information was leaked hurt what the FBI is trying to do going forward?
Well, I can tell you, Tanzina, as a former federal prosecutor, I never liked reading about matters we were working on in the newspaper. It never helps. If we had something to make public, we would make it public, and we would do so in federal court. That's where we talk. That's where we speak. In fact, that's the only place that you've heard from Mr. Mueller and his team. And so I think it's a fair bet that they would much prefer that their work remain under the radar until they decide it's time to say something in court.
Nick, there was also the Washington Post reported over the weekend really talking about the president and his one-on-one meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin. We know that the president has met with Putin before. What's new about what we learned over the weekend? It was not really a surprise that the president has not been as forthcoming with his meetings with Putin, with his staff?
I think the surprising thing was from that report was the lengths that he appears to have gone to keep what happened in those meetings relatively private. President Trump has always had, for Republican or Democrat, I think what Washington would consider an unorthodox view and of Mr. Putin, of American relations with Russia and what ought to happen with those. But what this report said in a pretty startling way was that in at least one instance, the president had gone as far as to try and take back the notes from the interpreter that was with him in the room with President Putin during one of these meetings. That would have been, you know, the official record that would have been relied on.
And was he successful
by other
in doing
career
that?
Officials? He was. I think in that case, the then Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, was also in the room and had given a kind of limited readout of what happened. But, you know, I think we knew this reporting came about and we were reading the story because other officials went to the interpreter and asked for those notes and asked for an account. And that person said what happened. So, you know, the president and the White House had a defense of this, which is that the president's trying to build a relationship. And obviously, they maintain that he hasn't said anything untoward in these meetings. But, you know, we saw over the summer when he met with President Putin privately again in Helsinki and then came out in what was a pretty remarkable and unusual, we can say, press conference for an American president where he seemed to agree with President Putin over American intelligence, with President Putin's conclusions about what had happened in 2016. So I think that there are reasons to be a little bit suspicious of why Trump is so trying to keep these things so close. But there's also reasons, I think, from his point of view, to understand why he would.
Chuck, what's the precedent for this type of behavior, particularly with when an American president meets with someone like Vladimir Putin, with taking these extreme measures to really keep things secret? Is that legal? Should there be some other sort of protocol that presidents have to go through when they meet with people like this?
Well, our president, regardless of party, regardless of person, is our chief diplomat. And so we would want that person to be able to have unfettered conversations, private if they wish, with any other world leader. That makes perfect sense to me. What doesn't make sense to me are all of the steps that this particular president has gone to mirror or parrot the Russian line on so many different topics. And so one conversation off the record or private, no trouble at all. In fact, that's what we would expect our presidents to do. But if you add it up, and prosecutors like to add up evidence, it looks dark. There's no reason, for instance, for the president to have misled Americans on the Trump Tower meeting. There's no reason for him to parrot the Russian line on the reasons for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. when you add all these things up, and as I said, prosecutors tend to do that, it begins to look more and more nefarious.
Nick, the president, President Trump, should I say, did respond to your reporting on Saturday night on Fox News. What was your take on that?
So he did on Fox News and sent a series of tweets earlier in the day, which set out this a series of defenses or kind of, you know, what he would call counterpunches that he had offered before, but he strung them together into a narrative in one of the most comprehensive ways we've seen so far that basically gave an alternate explanation. It was riddled with factual errors and unsubstantiated allegations that Hillary Clinton had lied to the FBI, that Jim Comey was corrupt, that Bob Mueller was his best friend and was covering up for him. I think the most interesting thing, though, was when he was asked on Fox News that night, you know, point blank, have you ever, you know, worked on behalf of Russian interests? And, you know, where one would expect a president or, you know, any reasonable person in Mr. Trump's situation to just flatly answer that question, he actually didn't give an answer. He just called the question the most insulting that he'd received. And then he referred back to our article and said it was the most insulting article he'd had written about him. And again, it's just it's another one of these instances where, given what, the accumulating record that we have now, you know, I think one can't help but wonder, you know, why not answer a simple no to that question? Is it because there is actually something that more there, as the FBI was wondering when he fired Jim Comey? Or is it simply, you know, this is a president whose behavior is erratic and often doesn't serve his own best interests?
Chuck, I'm wondering, I'm sure you heard the interview that we're referring to there with Judge Puro on Fox News and the president. Did the president's remarks on Fox News, were they an obstruction of justice or could they be construed as such?
I guess they could be construed as such. Nothing in that interview sort of hit me straight over the head as obstructive. But again, you have to look at the accumulation of evidence. In order to prove obstruction, a prosecutor would have to show a corrupt endeavor, a corrupt attempt. And so is the president merely rambling or venting? Possibly. He does that quite often. Or is he directing remarks for a specific purpose to a specific occurrence in order to try and turn testimony or warn somebody about giving the truth to the FBI? Possibly. But again, you have to look at facts as a whole. You have to take them together. What prosecutors often do, Tanzina, is rely on circumstantial evidence. It's probably an apt analogy for today in Washington, D.C. When you wake up and you see snow on the ground, that's circumstantial evidence that it snowed. You may not have watched it. You may not have been awake for it. But when you wake up and see it there, that's circumstantial evidence that it snowed. And circumstantial evidence, a judge will tell a jury, is every bit as compelling, powerful, and lawful as direct evidence. And what we have in this case, and maybe the Fox interview is more of the same, is lots and lots of pieces of circumstantial evidence, comments that the president has made that seem intended to obstruct the investigation.
Chuck Rosenberg is a former U.S. attorney. You can see him on MSNBC. And Nicholas Fandos is with The New York Times. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Throughout his 17 years in Congress, Iowa Representative Steve King has staked his name on racist, xenophobic messaging.
Where did any other subgroup of people contribute more to civilization?
Than white people?
Than Western civilization itself, that's rooted in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and the United States of America.
For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that they weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert.
Over the last 25 years, we've essentially phased out the promotion of assimilation and we promoted instead multiculturalism and diversity as if it were our strength.
Last week, he made headlines for an interview with the New York Times in which he asked,
quote, white nationalists, white supremacists, and this is from me, by the way, Mr. Speaker, white nationalists, white supremacists, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive?
The comments sparked a backlash in Washington, and not just among Democrats this time. Several top House and Senate Republicans have also spoken out against King's comments. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on CBS's Face the Nation this weekend.
action will be taken. I'm having a serious conversation with Congressman Steve King on his future and role in this Republican Party.
What does that mean?
Because as a leader, there is a number of things you'll see that has taken place, but I will not stand back as a leader of this party, believing in this nation that all are created equal, that stands or continues to stand and have any role with us.
King has responded to the backlash, saying he rejects the, quote, evil ideology of white nationalism and white supremacy, but still declared himself, quote, an advocate for Western civilization's values, which is a phrase that is still a racial dog whistle. Christopher Mathias is a national reporter with HuffPost. Christopher, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So King has been saying things like this since he was elected in 2002, probably even prior to that. Why do we care now? Why all the pearl clutching suddenly?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it basically took Steve King openly admitting to being a white supremacist in the New York Times to make this into a story. It's really interesting because Steve King said essentially the same thing as he said to the Times to an Iowa TV host back in October, where he said that he didn't think the term white nationalist was a derogatory term. And it's a little unclear, you know, why all this, it's gaining so much momentum now. It might just be because it was in the Times. But that said, you know, his white nationalism has been on full display for years.
And also the Republican Party's sort of turning a blind eye to not just his white nationalism, but as we've seen over the past 2 years in particular, a lot of really uncomfortable white nationalist rhetoric and behavior. Some prominent Republicans, as we said, are speaking out about these comments. Is it too late? I mean, does it really matter if we hear this from the Republican Party at this point?
I mean, I wouldn't give the Republicans too much credit for what they're doing right now. For example, I mean, you know, I've been asking Republicans for the last year what their stance is, and they've, you know, been completely silent. Ted Cruz, we saw yesterday, condemn Steve King. But then when he was asked, you know, whether he would support King in the future, he kind of changed the subject. Kim Reynolds, the governor of Iowa, King served as the co-chair of her campaign, you know, and was standing side by side with King the night before the election. It was only after the election that she chose to condemn him. Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa also was, you know, a big King supporter, and was only, you know, only tweeted a condemnation of him this week.
And let's be clear, tweeting condemnations is not any really doing anything. I mean,
let's be,
you know, I think people think when you know, thoughts and prayers and all that, it's a lot of empty rhetoric.
Exactly.
Right?
And we've been through this news cycle before, right, where King has done something completely outrageous and racist. There's a lot of uproar and then nothing happens. There's more momentum this time for real consequences, for him maybe to be stripped of a committeeship or to possibly be censured. Tim Ryan, a Democrat from Ohio, is apparently drafting some language for a censure. But even a censure is kind of toothless in a way.
What would that mean?
It's basically just a formal condemnation. It takes a simple majority in the House. I think, you know, if people really want to put their money where their mouth is and say that white supremacy is unacceptable in the House, I don't quite understand why people aren't talking about expelling him from Congress.
Well, that would actually be a consequence. I want to talk a little bit about, also we talked a little bit about the pearl clutching here. It seemed to be a little bit of pearl clutching around a different political figure. Media Matters put out a story that showed that Rashida Tlaib's use of a certain profane word that I'm sure we've all heard and if not have used ourselves, that got 5 times more coverage than Steve King's comments. Let's talk about the media's role in this. Because this purely is not a question of politics, right? I mean, why is it that the media is doing, you know, focus so much on Rashida's comments and not as much on King's?
I mean, that's a fantastic question. I wish I had a great answer. You know, I think it really exposes maybe the kind of the racist biases in media coverage. And it also kind of exposes, you know, how white supremacy is very much, you know, not limited to Steve King. And we're basically also, you know, all this pearl clutching by Republicans right now, they're coming out and condemning Steve King, yet turning around and supporting the border wall, which is Steve King's baby and something that he, you know, has been talking about since he's been in Congress.
Are there any other, are the Democrats considering taking further action than what we've already talked about? I mean, could there be some real consequences to this type of rhetoric?
That's something we're trying to figure out right now. me and some reporters at HuffPost are literally contacting every member of Congress to see where they stand on this. Like I said, Tim Ryan is drafting the censure language. In order to expel King, there would have to be a two-thirds majority in the House. Why don't they do that? I don't know. Why don't people have the guts to do that?
I think that's the question a lot of people are asking about our federal government and our Congress in general, right? Where are the guts to really handle this?
Exactly. And, you know, and one thing that this kind of news cycle has really exposed is that, you know, there's not a ton of daylight between Steve King and Donald Trump. And, you know, last night we saw Donald Trump tweet out a Pat Buchanan quote. You know, that's someone that Donald Trump himself in the late 1990s called a neo-Nazi. And now he's, you know, quoting him on Twitter.
I mean, I think we've jumped the shark on this, you know, quite a while ago. Christopher Mathias is a national reporter with the HuffPost covering the far right, disinformation, and hate. Thanks for joining us, Christopher.
Thank you.
We've all heard the stories of family separation at the border, but there's a different kind of family separation going on that fewer people know about, and it's playing out all over the country.
My name is Lori Lynn Adams. I'm a formerly incarcerated mother who had her parental rights stripped with no say-so.
Parents in prison are being completely stripped of their parental rights, even if they're imprisoned on a short sentence for a non-violent, low-level crime. Lori Lynn Adams is one of them.
My children at the time were 14, 2, 3, and 4.
The story of Lori's incarceration goes back to 1999, when Hurricane Floyd descended on her home in eastern North Carolina.
We were flooded, to say the least. Water inside of our mobile home, up to our windows inside. We stayed in the shelter for a while with all the kids because we had roads and everything else that was out. No one was able to get to their jobs much or do anything. So I ended up writing 75 plus worthless checks on my own account. And I went to prison on those checks 2 times.
Lori was also convicted on a charge of filing a fraudulent FEMA claim after the hurricane.
The first time was for 11 to 13 months, and the second time was as well.
While Lori was in prison, her kids first went to family, then a babysitter, before ending up in foster care. It was during her second sentence, when her children were in county custody, that she got a phone call from a family court attorney.
Tomorrow is a hearing, he told me, for parental rights. I spoke with this lawyer for the first time, had never met him or anything, and he informed me that they were going to take my rights and they were not going to bring me back to where I would have any say-so in the courthouse at all. My rights would just be stripped and I would no longer have my children at all. I was devastated. I couldn't figure out why they were being taken, but I wasn't there, so I didn't know what was going on, but it tore me to my core. It's nothing I would wish upon anybody.
Lori did not know this was something that could happen to her.
I never claimed to be the best parent in the world, but I had never had any neglect or abuse cases brought against me. They were blessings in my life. No one ever told me how to keep from losing my children, what I needed to do to continue to have my parental rights. No one ever told me how. I had no say-so in the matter whatsoever.
After that, Lori was forbidden from seeing or contacting her children.
Once I was released, I decided not to go back to my hometown because I knew that I would be in trouble or because I would look for my children. I just knew it was best if I did not go back home. So I worried and stuff, and once in a while, I would hear little bits and pieces from people that knew who my children were and knew the situation of where they were at and stuff, and, you know, would just tell me that they were looking good, stuff, you know, that they had seen. When the lady was fixing to adopt them, she found me somehow and called me one day and asked me not to intervene because she was going to adopt, their adoption was fixing to be finalized.
It soon became clear to Lori that there would be little recourse.
When I was released from prison after my parental rights were taken, I filed for an appeal through the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and they denied everything. So they didn't jump into family matters, from what I understand, if they didn't like to overturn a family court judge's decision in the matters, especially after a period of time. I had thought about hiring a lawyer, but I knew there was no way I could afford a lawyer to do anything as far as try to get the kids back.
It was almost a decade before Lori would have contact with her children again. To this day, she's still trying to rebuild relationships with them.
We have a small bond. My son and I still have not talked through or gone through a whole lot. He asked me to give him his space, and I have ultimately told him, yes, anytime, you know, take as long as you need, and I'm here when you get ready in your time. But the girls, we have a relationship. We get together. I go and see them frequently, or get the grand girls and keep them some, and we talk a lot over the phone, and we haven't built all the way back, and there's still some resentment there and heartache and stuff, but we're trying.
Lori says she blames herself for a lot of what's happened to her family.
Lots of regrets, lots and lots. If there was some way you could go back in time and change your past, oh, several things would be done different, and I would have raised them and had them during different stages that you just look at, like first day of school, first day of dance class, anything that they did that I missed out on. I would love to go back and have that, you know, but there's no going back. I don't know how things can happen the way they happen, but it happened to me. And I'm sure it's happened to many other people in the past. But if I can help to change anything for one child and one parent, not to lose your child and lose your bond, it's a blessing.
Eli Hager tells Lori's story in his reporting for the Marshall Project, where he's a staff writer.
And this was all based on, you know, the offense of writing bad checks. And so kind of the question we wanted that story to raise was whether a collateral consequence of a pretty low-level crime like that should be losing your kids forever.
So how does this happen? How do parents incarcerated for low-level offenses end up completely losing the rights to their own children?
Well, it happens for two reasons. The first is that there's a federal law called the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which was passed during the Clinton administration in 1997. And it sets a timeline of 15 months that kids can be in foster care for before they get adopted. And so since a lot of parents, most parents, in fact, who go to prison are there for longer than 15 months, their kids might be adopted out of foster care because of that timeline, so they can lose their kids forever. And then the other reason is that from prison, they can't do a lot of the things that other parents do to prove that they're good parents and deserve to be reunited with their kids. So that includes attending family court. They can't do that from prison. Having a job, having housing, paying child support. They can't really do those things from prison. And just regular visitation with their kids. They can't do any of that stuff from prisons, which are often hundreds of miles away from home.
So how did that law come to be? I mean, what was the context around its passage?
In the 80s and 90s, the foster care caseload in this country really expanded, and there was concern among a lot of child advocates that kids were languishing for too long in foster care, which is not generally a good place for kids. And they called it foster care drift. And to remedy that problem, they came up with this law, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, where they set a strict timeline for how long kids could be in foster care before they would get adopted, which at the time, child advocates saw adoption as a much better outcome for kids. But they didn't really foresee this consequence for incarcerated parents, because at that time, there weren't as many incarcerated parents, but now there's the incarcerated parent population has exploded. And so parents who go to prison for more than 15 months can lose their kids forever just because of this timeline that was set up in 1997.
And so this seems pretty severe. I mean, we understand that doing time for a crime that's been committed is obviously something that has to happen, but taking away a child permanently from a parent seems to be severe. Are there any arguments for this practice?
Well, obviously, there are some cases in which the very reason why parents are in prison is child abuse. And so there are arguments in child abuse cases that those children should be taken away from their parents. But in our analysis, we actually found that parents who are incarcerated are more likely to lose their kids forever and have their parental rights terminated than are parents who physically or sexually abuse their children, which we found pretty striking.
Wait, why is that? Do we know why that is?
Well, just because it's so difficult from prison, some of those practical barriers that I was talking about before, like attending family court, you know, maintaining visitation with your kids. If you're the judge in family court, you might just think this parent is gone or has abandoned their kid. There's not a lot of communication. And so it's very easy to terminate these parents' rights because they can't really speak up for themselves from prison.
And let's talk a little bit about the landscape here. How many people does this affect, and who are the demographic that are most affected by this?
Well, at the Marshall Project, we obtained a database of over 13 million child welfare records dating back to 1998. And we analyzed those, and we found that over the past decade, about 32 million parents who had been incarcerated lost their kids forever and weren't able to see them again because their parental rights were terminated. About 5 million of those cases, their rights were terminated because of their incarceration alone, and no other factors were involved, according to our analysis. So it's thousands of parents, and it's mainly mothers, because mothers are most likely to have been their child's only caretaker before going to prison.
What are some of the arguments against this practice? Obviously, I assume there are activists who are trying to modify or change this.
Yeah, so over the last few years, advocates for parents in three states, New York, Washington State, and Illinois, have gotten laws passed that make incarceration an exception to these timelines for terminating parents' rights. So essentially, if you're incarcerated, you can say, I deserve a little bit longer to try to reunite with my kids because I have these obstacles that I'm facing because I'm behind bars. And that these laws that they've gotten passed have also done things like require parents to be notified of their family court dates, even if they're in prison, required child welfare agencies to make visitation between parents and kids more possible, even in prisons, things like that. And so those are the things that they're fighting for.
I'm wondering, what do we know about what's best for children? Is there any research that tells us what is the best thing to do for children when their parents, if their parents are incarcerated?
Right. So there's a lot of research, and it's a little bit hard to parse through. But what we definitely know is that all else being equal, maintaining some connection with your birth families, not just your parents, but also your siblings and other relatives, is really healthy and something that allows kids to do better in their lives by all kinds of metrics. And so one of the things that a lot of parent advocates have said is, even if a parent is off in prison or is facing other challenges, why terminate their rights permanently and irrevocably? Why not figure out family guardianship situations where they can stay with another relative and still have a relationship with their parents and families and not have that just ended permanently in this way that can be very scarring for kids?
I mean, how does this compare to child welfare cases with a parent who isn't incarcerated?
Well, the main way that it's different, like I said, is that parents who aren't incarcerated can obviously attend family court more regularly and make a case for themselves there. They can visit with their kids directly and not in a prison setting. They can get a job and pay child support, and they can, you know, make efforts to obtain housing, which is another thing that judges look for. So all of those things can help them prove that they're ready to be a parent and stable enough to have the kids back in the home.
Eli Hager is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. Eli, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
As the shutdown rolls on, we're still hearing your reactions.
My name is Mick DeGrave, and we have an environmental services company in Traverse City, Michigan. It's a small employee-owned business, 60 people. Our work is 60 to 65% federal contracts, and 2 days ago we laid off 40 people. They all are people who need this money. Many of them have limited access to savings and so forth, and of course we want to keep them. So this is something that makes me want to recommend that these folks in Washington start thinking about people other than themselves.
This is Robert Soto. I'm from Orlando, Florida. You know, it really does strike me that all these individuals are in such dire financial situations. Any good economist says, hey, have 6 months savings. And this is part of the overall problem. Our politicians are not guiding us properly. They're not saying, look, eat better, have some money saved, just good old-fashioned values.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I worked for the U.S. Forest Service for close to 7 years. In the last 9 months, have left my career with the Forest Service due to the fact that I don't believe they have our best intentions up front and center. Got a job in local government. It's an incredible organization. I'm so glad I left, and I really sympathize for all the people I know and the people I'm hearing about that are dealing with this government shutdown being that it's so long.
Is the shutdown affecting you or those around you? Tell us about it. Leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we might use your response on air. And check us out on Instagram, where we share photos from behind the scenes on the show, plus lots more. Until tomorrow, thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.